Health Hour on cliffcentral.com.
Well, it's a very good morning to you from me, Dr. Cindy Fansale. And this morning, I'll be chatting to Dr. Liz Gwither. She's from the Hospice and Palliative Care Association of South Africa. So I'm really, really glad to have her on the show because she's done phenomenal work in the field of palliative care. And it's always amazing to speak to people like Liz because it takes a lot out of you to be involved in such a field, you know. And I especially remember when I was working at Barra during the time, the height of the HIV deaths, you know, a lot of patients had to go into hospices, and the hospices in Soweto were full and you couldn't get a space and so on. And I remember that, especially in December when patients were really sick, family members would want to know if you know, if people could be put in hospice until they got better and so on. So when I think of hospices and I think of palliative care, I always, you know, I always look back on those days and I remember, you know, trying to get spaces for patients and so on. But anyway, Liz, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Dr. Cindy, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, first of all, Liz, I commend you on the work that you do. You've been involved in palliative care for many, many years. And it's not, I don't think it's a field that many people go into. So what drew you to the field of palliative care?
Well, my work was in general practice, Dr. Cindy. So part of general practice is seeing people throughout their life course. So I was doing obstetric work and delivering babies,
yeah,
and looking after people in the family, and yeah, then looking after people who had life-threatening and terminal illnesses and were going to die. And I realized that I hadn't been trained at all in that discipline when I'd been at medical school, so looked for ways to improve my knowledge about palliative care.
Mm.
And then I was working in a little town called Somerset West in the Western Cape, and they opened a hospice, and they asked general practitioners to assist them with the after-hours care of their patients. And so that's how I really got involved. And I did most of my initial learning from the palliative care nurses at the hospice and from the social worker at the hospice, who taught me most of my counseling skills.
That's awesome. That is awesome because, and you're right about the medical schools not spending enough time with, you know, on palliative care. I know when we rotated through palliative care, it was a short rotation. I don't think many of us took it seriously. And, you know, when I look back now, I wish we had, because there's more to it than just finding a space for a patient that's terminally ill. The counseling skills you speak about are so important.
Yes, they are very important. And I actually found that when I did do my formal training in palliative care, it actually made me a better all-round doctor anyway, for whatever discipline I was working in or whatever problem I was faced with.
That's amazing. And you've been recently appointed as the, you know, to chair the World Hospice Association.
Yes, I'm now the chairperson of the Worldwide Hospice Palliative Care Alliance.
That's awesome, Liz. And how did that come about?
Well, it came about really international colleagues. It really came about through going to international conferences,
mm-hmm,
and meeting other colleagues who were working in palliative care, but recognizing that the unique position of a hospice palliative care association that helps to coordinate activities and try and raise awareness about palliative care in each country, that we could share the best practices worldwide. So a colleague of mine from the United Kingdom had this idea of having a kind of global voice and how we could influence palliative care worldwide.
And that's amazing. That's awesome. And I think, you know, to have people like you who are very passionate about the field, you know, to have a person like you heading such a body, I mean, you'll be able to influence people from all across the world.
Well, that is what we try to do. And I think that what makes it more effective is that there are many of us. So it's not just one person. There's a whole team of people with a lot of different skills. And one of our most effective partnerships has been with Human Rights Watch, who are come at it from a human rights perspective and with training as lawyers. So they, you know, we've always been as palliative care quite quiet and in the background and saying to people in power and policymakers, you know, how can we help you improve the healthcare system? Human Rights Watch, they you're doing a dreadful job. Look at how many people are in pain, and they're quite confrontational.
Mm.
But it's been a good partnership because they do the confrontational bit, and then the hospitality care people come behind them and say, so we've got the answers. How can we help you improve things in your country?
That's awesome. So just going back to like zoning in on the organization that you chair, the Hospice and Palliative Care Association, where are you based and how did that association come about? And just tell us a bit of what it's all about.
Okay. So the Hospice Palliative Care Association was founded in 1987, and it came about at that stage there were 15 hospices in South Africa, which had, and the initial ones had been the Hospice in Joburg, Hospice Association of Witwatersrand, St. Luke's Hospice in Cape Town, and Highway Hospice in Durban. And in fact, it was the hospices in KwaZulu-Natal that said, we need to get together and share best practice. So the Hospice Palliative Care Association was founded with Archbishop Desmond Tutu as our first patron, and Professor J.P. Simicek, who at the time was the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at UCT, as our chairperson.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's being based in Cape Town, and so the head office is in Cape Town. But we now have 156 member hospices across the country, and with hospices in, I think it's 39 of the 54 health districts. And the province that is least well-served is in Limpopo. We only have two hospices in Limpopo, but we are changing our focus more. Rather than having NGOs providing palliative care, or only NGOs providing palliative care, we're working very closely with the Department of Health to integrate palliative care into every level of the health system.
Okay.
And, of course, it also means that we need to work with the Department of Social Development so that there's palliative care in old age homes and in children's homes as well.
Okay. And it's important because I must say the most of the hospices that I know of are NGO funded and run by NGOs.
Yes, and it's very precarious funding. So we've actually had about 10 hospices close in the last 2 years because of lack of funding.
Okay, and then what happens to those hospices? Do you guys take them over? What happens, you know, do they just close down and that's it?
Well, in some places, larger hospices have been able to take over and to help the patients who have that need. For example, hospice in the West in Krugersdorp closed recently, and the Hospice Association of Witwatersrand has absorbed a lot of their patients. But there are other hospices, especially in the rural areas, that when they close, there isn't that opportunity for palliative care for patients needing that care, and so it's so important that palliative care now should be available in the health system because it means that people must get it from the clinic.
Mm.
But having said that, a lot of people who are later in their illness really need the care in the home. So we need to find a way to get the professional care or the home-based carers to people in their homes that they don't have to go to a clinic or a hospital for an illness that there isn't much that the acute health care system can help them with.
Yeah, I hear you. And for me, Liz, I think when I first started working with HIV patients, I think I was filled with a lot of fear, especially when, you know, patients came in end-stage AIDS and, you know, you knew that this person was going to die. I think a lot of us are filled with fear. A lot of medical practitioners just don't know where to begin with a patient that's really, really ill.
Yeah. And I think that's because we weren't trained in managing chronic illness and definitely not trained in managing people with terminal illness.
Yeah.
So we know how to cure. That's what doctors are trained to do, still trained to do. I mean, there's more access, there's more palliative care training in medical schools these days than there was nothing when I was training.
Mm.
And a lot of it is really just discovering the patient's needs and the patient's wishes. And palliative care really looks at the specific symptoms. So it's not what disease has a person got or what illness is it, it's what are your actual needs. And I found in doing a survey of home-based care compared to hospital care. But in hospitals, we don't ask about pain and other symptoms and worry and anxiety.
We don't.
So we talk about the illness. And in HIV, I mean, I think the HIV clinicians have come a great way, and they are talking a lot about pain and symptoms. And I think the change in the face of the HIV epidemic has been quite encouraging, because the time you're talking about, and when hospice got involved in HIV care in the 1990s, having contracted HIV meant you were going to die.
Yeah.
So now the work that the government has done to make sure that people are accessing antiretrovirals has changed it completely.
Totally.
So people can live a long, normal life, provided they're on their treatment. So most of the work we're doing with HIV patients is looking at how do we help people to stay on their treatment and to manage the symptoms that might be part of the HIV or might be part of the treatment, and supporting them, because quite a lot of the issues in palliative care in South Africa are more social issues than medical issues.
Mm. And in terms of family support, I mean, so you have a family, a member who's in a hospice, or you know, who's, you know, receiving palliative care. Do you guys also provide support for the family? You know, because they
Absolutely.
Obviously need counselling and so on.
Yes. So there are many ways that we support families. One of the things about hospice in South Africa is that we have very few inpatient facilities, so very few beds. So most of our care is nurses or care workers going to look after people at home.
Okay.
And it actually means that the people who have the majority of the burden of the care are family members.
Okay.
And so the one thing is helping family members to know how to care for a person who's ill. And the other is looking at the impact on the illness on that family member as well. What kind of emotional support do they need? What kind of can we get a grant? Is there financial support that we can help with? And then, especially during the time when a patient may be dying or after they've died, the hospice is very skilled in providing bereavement support. And we'll often visit the family or be alongside the family for 13 months so that we cover the first year anniversary of the death.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. I mean, Liz, I'm feeling a bit wobbly this morning because one of my favorite patients passed away. I was saying on Twitter that doctors have favorite patients. I mean, I work in the field of HIV, and this guy was my favorite patient. And he died. I mean, I saw him a week ago. He got sick. He just deteriorated. He got admitted into hospital. 2 days later, he was in ICU, and he passed away. And, you know, and I'm feeling like this, and he was just my patient. So I'm trying to imagine if you have a family member and you know that they're going to pass away, you can see what's going on. You know, it's good to know that you guys are there as a support structure. It's good to know that you're there for 13 months to make sure that you know that you get through the 1 year anniversary and so on. It's amazing.
Yeah, and to support the patient and the family with their choices, the things that they want, the way they want to be cared for during those last months or weeks or days of life. And a lot of people would prefer to be at home, and yet too many people are admitted to hospital and actually die in hospital without having their family with them. And they would prefer to be at home in a comfortable place. But there's that uncertainty of, if they go into hospital, will they get better? And that's the wish that people often have, which makes a lot of people rush to hospital when it's actually the final event. So it's really important. We're trying to promote having an advanced care plan and an advanced directive or living will that means that people have thought about what happens if they become sick. Mm-hmm. And I know that overseas, both in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, there's an actual day that's called Advanced Care Planning Day on the 16th of April. And we're planning to publicize, you know, let's talk about what would happen if we get ill and what would be our choices, so that people have it written down and we have an advanced directive or a living will to guide doctors and our family members who might be helping make choices about our care.
So they know what we want.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm very sad to hear about your favourite patient passing away, Dr. Cindy. It's always a loss and bereavement for the healthcare professionals as well.
I mean, I don't know how you cope. I cry. Crying is my therapy. But how do you, I mean, do you guys have support structures for your workers as well? Because I can imagine it must be very draining at times.
Yeah.
So do you have caring for the carers? What do you have in place?
Yeah, we have a very strong care for the caregiver program. So partly it's kind of understanding how your work impacts on yourself. But palliative care work is in fact very rewarding, because we can make such a difference. If we can help a person who's in pain and treat their pain so that they're no longer in pain and can live actively throughout their life, however long they've got, or help with other symptoms, or help with the emotional or spiritual distress that people have, it's a time when we can make a lot of difference, so it's very rewarding. But it is a time when we become very close to our patients. So when somebody dies and we're supporting a family, there's that emotional burden that we carry ourselves. And our staff are really good at supporting each other. So if somebody has lost a patient, then they will look out for him or her and make sure they're doing all right. And then that person supports the next one if that occurs as well. And I think the knowledge that we've done a good job, that a person has died in comfort and in peace in their own home, and that the families are so grateful for the work that the hospice has done, that that's also very affirming. And I think the thing that we are taught, the very first thing that we teach in palliative care or that we learn in palliative care, is that we affirm life, so it's very important that we have quality of life and live positively, but we recognize that death is a normal process, that death happens to us all. And actually, that's a very unnatural thing in our society. We don't talk about death. We don't think, you know, it could happen to me. It might happen to you, but it's not going to happen to me.
Exactly.
And there's this death-denying kind of society.
Well, that's the reason why I'm so wobbly. But that's the thing, Liz. That's the reason why I'm so wobbly. I'm so used to getting patients in, start them on treatment. Yes. 3 months later, everything's going well. 4 months later, everything's going well. And then death has just, it's almost cracked me. I'm like, what? How did that happen? You know? And you're right. And then,
kind of go over and over in your mind, what could you have done differently, and is there something else that would have helped, and all sorts of things. Whereas, in fact, death is part of the cycle of life, and it may be that some people die too early because of their illness. And, you know, when we think about palliative care for children, we kind of think, oh, no, it's not natural that a child should die. And any parent at any age will say, my child shouldn't die before I die.
It's
not part of the cycle of life. But it does happen, and we need to recognize that a child with a genetic disorder or something incurable may also die, and we have to give the best possible care there as well.
Oh, but Liz, that must be so difficult. That must be very difficult.
I do think that my colleagues in pediatric care are very special people.
Yeah, because I love pediatrics. I always tell people that I'm a closet pediatrician, but because of all the babies that I saw dying at Barrow when I was rotating there, that I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle having to, because you know how in our systems, and we are the ones, the doctors are the ones that have to tell the family that so and so has passed away. So telling a mom that her baby had died and just watching her reaction and her horror and her screams and so on, I never ever recovered from that. And that's why I think pediatric palliative care must be very hard.
But at the same time, the support that one can give to the family is also so valued.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll be back after this, Liz, and we'll just don't go away. We'll be back after this, and we'll carry on chatting about all the work that you've done. And I specifically want to talk about pain, because I know you've done a lot of work in the field of pain, something that's very important. So stay on the line.
Thank you.
Okay.
On my shoulders, I carry the hopes and dreams of generations to come. I'm eager to learn, but even more eager to use my knowledge for good. I know that it's not where I come from, but but where I'm going to that really matters.
At Sibanye-Gold, we believe our youth is worth its weight in gold, which is why we are so committed to developing, nurturing, and grooming our young people into future leaders. Sibanye-Gold, we are one.
This is CliffCentral.com.
And so we're back on the Health Hour with Dr. Liz Gwither, and she's the CEO of the Hospice and Palliative Care Association of South Africa, and she's also the chairperson of the Worldwide Hospice Association, and that's really awesome. That's a fantastic accolade on for her. Liz, welcome back.
Thank you.
So Liz, we were talking about pain. You mentioned pain, managing pain. So I wanted to go into more detail, because I think that's definitely the one area of medicine that even today, I've been a doctor for about 10 years, I still have, you know, issues around managing pain and so on. So just tell us a bit about that. I mean, I know you've done excellent work in that field.
Okay. So I think that one of the big problems in managing pain is that as doctors and nurses, we are all taught that morphine and opioid medication is dangerous, and it's not. I think we have to unlearn that and learn that morphine is safe, effective, easy to use, provided we've been trained in it. And we just have to be as cautious with opioid medication as we are with any other kind of prescription. And the problem stemmed from 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs.
Okay.
Where there was a plan that was at the United Nations, there was a worry about drug addiction, and it came out that we have to control the use of opioids. So currently, and there's recently been a study done by the World Health Organization that is looking at access to controlled medication, that 83% of the world's population, 5.5 billion people, live in countries with no access to opioid medication at all.
Mm.
So people who are in pain have to suffer excruciating pain. And Human Rights Watch has done a lot of work looking at this and looking at the epidemic of suicides that has happened in Russia, for example, where there's no access to opioids.
Sure.
So in South Africa, we are very fortunate that we have very reasonable prescribing laws about the use of opioids. And the International Narcotics Control Board has brought out a very good paper that says there needs to be a balance between access to morphine for people who need it for pain and the abuse of, and it's not usually morphine that's abused, it's other kind of narcotic drugs or methamphetamines even that are really the problems in drug control.
Mm.
So we feel that because there's this concern about morphine and its danger and it being addictive, that people don't get adequate pain management and pain control. And partly, again, our medical students and our nursing students are not taught how to assess pain properly and how to manage pain effectively.
Mm.
So this is something that we really need to improve. And I also sit on the Pain SA Council, which is the South African chapter of the International Association for the Study of Pain.
Oh, that's fantastic.
To try and make sure that there's better education about pain and pain management, both for healthcare professionals and for patients who might need their pain control.
That's excellent. That's so important. I think if this message can keep going, you know, filter down to medical schools and making sure that the students that are coming through and the nursing students that are coming through are aware of all of this, I think we'll improve the system dramatically.
Absolutely. And pain seems to be one of the most devastating symptoms that people fear and people experience. And in fact, it's probably about 65%, I think, is the figure of patients actually present to their doctor because of pain.
Mm.
And the doctor doesn't treat the pain. The doctor says, oh, the pain is due to this illness, and treats that illness and expects the pain, which it will do, the pain will get better when that illness is improve, but how many days of pain does that person have to suffer in the meantime?
And many times they can't go to work. It affects your whole life.
Yes.
It affects your whole life. And in terms of, you spoke about Limpopo earlier on, that they only have two hospices. How does a situation like that come about, Liz? I mean, I'm trying to, in Soweto alone, I can't even count how many hospices you have in Soweto alone. And now you have a province that only has two.
Okay. So the issue is that until recently, palliative care has been an NGO function. So it's been two hospices. And at the beginning, hospices were established in communities that could afford them because they were only funded by community donations. Mm. And our hospices have done quite a lot of good work in kind of twinning, or sharing their resources in different communities. So like St. Luke's Hospice in Cape Town has got 10 community branches.
Okay.
And the West Coast branch in Tableview twins with the Kyalicha branch. So any funds that are raised in West Coast also go to Kyalicha. But it's the same that the whole hospice kind of shares resources on how they receive donations.
Okay.
But if you're in an impoverished community and in a province where funding is not flowing to charity sectors, then one can't afford a hospice. One of the things we did, we were fortunate enough to receive funding from the United States Agency for International Development, USAID.
Yes.
And for about 10 years, we were able to develop hospices in the underserved communities. So we moved from 50 hospices when we first got the funding in 2004. We moved up to 202 hospices at the height of this funding in 2011. And unfortunately, we've now dropped back to about 156 hospices.
Okay, because so the funding's been cut back, and so obviously a lot of them had to close down.
Yes.
Sure. And if a family member was to, you know, apply for someone to be taken to a hospice, what's the procedure? What's the process? Does it have to be a referral? How does that work?
Okay. So most hospices ask for information about the person who's being referred to hospice, and they do need the medical details. So they do want a referral from the doctor, but the initial referral doesn't have to come from the doctor, because we also look for the family details.
Mm.
So a family member or community member or somebody from the church can say, you know, would you come and visit this patient? And then we say, please, would you ask your doctor to complete this part of the form that tells us the diagnosis, the medication the person is on, what kind of interventions have been done, and how, you know, the clinical condition of the person who's being referred.
Mm.
And most hospices take about 2 to 3 days to process all of that and for the nurse to schedule a visit.
Yeah.
And then the professional nurse will do a visit, often in the home, and will develop an individual care plan. What is it that the person needs, depending on what their problems are? And if it's an emergency, there are some hospices that have beds that may take a person in, or there are hospices that don't have beds but have an arrangement with a care home or a hospital around setting the original care plan in place.
Okay.
But once there's a care plan and the worst of the symptoms are controlled, then the care happens in the home.
Oh, okay. And then once a patient is better, then they're transferred back home, and then you can carry on there.
Yes.
Oh, okay. And then the medication and all of those things, who foots the bill for that, Liz? I think, you know, because I know that the hospices that I used to see, obviously the Department of Health was paying, or whichever department was paying,
yes,
or the NGO. But so who generally foots the bill for all of that stuff?
So mostly there's an arrangement with the Department of Health, either clinic or hospital. So the patient will continue with their folder at the clinic or the hospital,
mm-hmm,
and the nurse or the doctor at the hospice will have that discussion with either the clinic or the hospital. So it depends where you work. When I was working at Helderberg Hospice in Somerset West,
yeah.
I had prescribing privileges with the Hottentot Holland Hospital. So I could write on the hospital prescription pad, and that would be honored by their pharmacy.
Okay.
Or sometimes the doctor will write the prescription, and the hospice nurse will take the prescription to the doctor at the hospital, and he or she will rewrite that.
Okay.
Or sometimes we have to do a whole referral. And if a patient is really sick and really too ill to travel, and we've done this assessment, but they have to be seen by a hospital doctor in order to get the medication, then we have to refer. So it's kind of duplicating the work, which, you know, the health system in our country, we can't afford to duplicate work
because
there's so much other work to do. So it depends where you are, what you get that. But it means that the medication does come from the state.
Okay, that's good.
Hospices cannot afford to also run a pharmacy.
You can't. No, I understand that, yeah. And in terms of the cases that you primarily see, I mean, I know that with the advent of antiretroviral treatment, that has changed the face of HIV totally. So I'm sure you're seeing much less HIV-related admissions, right?
Much fewer admissions, but still quite a lot of home care. So nationally, our statistics around HIV has dropped from about 83% of our patients being HIV to about 60%. And we see in quite a lot of people with chronic conditions, so heart failure, diabetes, renal failure, those kinds of things. And then we think that we're not seeing enough cancer patients.
So you think you're not seeing enough?
Yes. We have a relatively small proportion. About 10% of the patients we see are cancer patients.
I thought it would be more.
And we do hear that there are cancer patients who remain in oncology services with active treatment for oncology, or changing from the first regimen of oncology treatment to the second and third and fourth without there being palliative care involved. And we're concerned that the oncologists are not referring enough to us.
I can't imagine, a cancer patient, you know, going through those phases without involving palliative care.
Well, one would think. But it's so much that So again, it's how a person is trained, and the oncologists are trained to cure cancer. The fact that 60% of their patient load at any one time is non-curable, they still are in the curative mode, and they don't think to involve the palliative care clinician at the same time.
Sure. And are you able to, have you done any outreach to oncologists? Is there a way of reaching them?
Yes, we do, and a lot of hospices have quite good relationships with oncologists and do get some referrals, but it's for the oncologist to recognize when palliative care should be involved.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the areas that we are focusing on, I'm part of the World Health Organization Technical Advisory Group on Palliative Care. And at that forum, and also in South Africa, we are working on a document that says, so how do you identify the person who needs palliative care or who could benefit from palliative care? And the idea is that we don't have to have a prognosis of saying, well, they're going to die this year or they're going to die next year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking at what are their needs. So have they got severe symptoms? Have they got stage 3 or 4 cancer? If the staging of the cancer has reached 3, and definitely if there's metastasis, so it's 4, the person needs palliative care. But for a person with heart failure or a person with emphysema, we also look at how frequently have they been hospitalized for their condition.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at what is their kind of, we call it a performance status. What kind of functions can they do at home? You know, have they been able to do less and less? If they are homebound or bedbound, they really need palliative care.
Yes, definitely.
But both for the patient and for the family and for the doctor, there's this idea of, oh, no, there might be something that will change this and we might get better. And there's that is that hope. And I think that it's really important to nurture a person's hope for, well, in palliative care, for the best possible quality of life. But if you're offering the patient with metastatic cancer cure, you actually, that's not realistic hope, that you're fooling them. You're not being truthful towards them.
Yeah, and again, and I guess it's this fear of discussing, it's this fear of discussing death. So you're saying ideally you should be having as upfront discussions as possible.
Yes. And it doesn't have to be a discussion about death. It's a discussion about what would your choices be. Again, so we're talking about the advanced directive idea.
Okay.
What are the things that you are hoping for? And what are your goals? You know, you now have a serious illness. And I think that's the one thing that we have to, the one word that we can use that is not like talking about death and dying, so something that's overwhelmingly fearful, but it acknowledges what that patient is experiencing. If we say, oh, no, this isn't a serious illness, you're going to get better, the patient thinks, but then why am I feeling so grim? Why can't I do this? Why is this? Why that? If you say to a person, it is a serious illness, but we can help make things a whole lot better because we can definitely control pain and we can control other distressing symptoms and we can help you achieve what you want to achieve. What are your goals now? And what should be our goals of care? What are the things you're hoping to do in the next year or the next 6 months? And how can we help you achieve those?
That's a good conversation. I think that's a very good way of going about it, Liz. And I'm glad that I'm chatting to you because I am also learning a lot, you know, from this conversation. And just in terms of the future, your future plans, you know, as we wrap up, what does the future look like for you? Where can we find you, you know?
Okay. So the future is actually looking very bright in South Africa. Our government was one of the governments that proposed a resolution at the World Health Assembly that said that palliative care should be integrated in the health system. And following on that, they've put together a strategic advisory group for the minister on developing a palliative care policy for the country and then making sure that we implement palliative care in the health system and that there's education for all healthcare professionals. However, it suits people to do that, whether it's an online course or whether it's going to the university to do a diploma course and making sure our medical students have this in place. So I think that we're going to have a great deal of improvement in South Africa. And one of the things that has happened is that every 3 years, the Economist Intelligence Unit put out a quality of death index that says what is the access to palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
They've done it twice, and both times the UK has been top. And the last time they did it, South Africa was number 40 and is now number 34 of 80 countries in the world that have been ranked.
Okay.
And South Africa is the top country in Africa.
Okay.
So we can still do quite a lot better, but we're on that path at the moment. So both for the Hospice Palliative Care Association and for my other job at the University of Cape Town where I teach palliative medicine, there is a lot of focus on educating the public so the people who might need palliative care, which also includes you and me, because one day it's going to be forecast.
I know.
And so it's our job now to make sure that in the future we get better care.
Yes.
And that there's better care for our parents and those kinds of things at the moment. So educating the public and educating the healthcare professionals, that needs to be our focus at the moment. And then this advice and assistance to the government and to the minister to improve palliative care in this country.
No, thank you so much, Liz. And how can we get hold of you? If someone wants to email you or get in touch with you, how can they get hold of you?
So we've got a website that's www.hpca.co.za, and on the website there's a option to find a hospice if people need to find a hospice, and it's got the listing of wherever our hospices are. Our phone number is in Cape Town, 021-531-0277.
Okay.
And then my personal email address is liz@hpca.co.za.
Okay, great.
So those are different ways of getting hold of us, and you can like us and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and there's a global Twitter chat that happens every Monday
okay.
at 1 o'clock GMT, so at 1 o'clock in the UK, and that's called 8 p.m., standing for Hospice Palliative Medicine Global, and people can tweet about different things. We recently had a tweet chat about access to medication, and somebody has put up a map that says there's 95% of the morphine used in the world is used in 7 countries to
sure.
get adequate, reasonable pain management, and the rest, 5% of the rest of the population in the world have poor pain management. It's quite
It is very scary. But yeah, no, thank you very much, Liz. It was awesome chatting
okay.
to you. And I'll make sure that we put out all your details. And as soon as the podcast is up, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you
thank
very
you
much.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Health Hour on CliffCentral.com.